Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Bob Morris used to be a self-described curmudgeon and dog skeptic. But a miniature dachshund changed all that. Bob writes about it in his essay, An Affection Multiplier with 4 feet and a Wet Nose. Zachary Quinto reads this week's essay. He's known for playing Spock in Star Trek, and he's starring now in AMC's Nosferatu.
The 9-pound long-haired miniature dachshund at the animal shelter wasn't the kind of dog I imagined walking in Manhattan. She was a little lapdog and a cliché, too small for someone as insecure and image-conscious as me. And her name was Zoe, too cutesy. I put a deposit down on her anyway. A form to fill out asked, "Why do you want a dog?" The answer should have been simple, companionship. But it was more complicated than that. I always swore I'd never get a dog. In fact, I'd spent the first half of my life as a dog denigrator. Why have a needy pet with so many needy people in the world? One divorced friend has spent the last 6 years lounging around too intimately with a slobbering golden retriever who is as devoted to her as her ex was not. Another single woman I know thinks that if her Maltese snaps at someone she's dating, he's probably not right for her. Talk about snap judgments. I once had a date with a handsome man and his handsome Portuguese water dog who were so interested in each other they paid no attention to me. "You don't understand," friend said. "Dogs are all about unconditional love." Okay, but what about earned love and common sense? When I first met Ira, who would become my spouse, he owned, or perhaps I should say was owned by, a beloved Cairn Terrier that would lunge and bite whenever we tried to leave him, and would refuse to go out for walks because he hated the noisy city streets. With a push from me, Ira finally put the dog into a carrier bag and flew him off to a better life, with a loving stay-at-home owner in a quieter, leafier city. For several years, it was just the two of us, in our white antiseptic apartment, living our pet-free and child-free lives of stylish travel, creative careers, and limited family responsibility. Not that Ira wasn't a handful all his own. He was often so vulnerable, voluble, and, shall I say, doggedly affectionate that it scared me. When I started saying, "I want a dog," it was half in jest. But it became more serious as I cooed at dogs on the sidewalk, beagles in particular, while Ira shook his head. "You have a limited amount of affection to give," he said without irony. "If we get a dog, all your affection will go to him, and there won't be any left for me." Maybe he was right. I've always made it a goal to not be too needed, even by my aging mother and father. But last winter was a tough one. After my parents' deaths, I'd been in conflict with my brother, and I was facing daunting tax and career troubles. Ira was troubled, too. Maybe a dog would change things, or at least cheer us up. But the question did come into my head. Was there something lacking in our lives as a couple that I wanted a dog to fulfill? It's common enough for the presence of a baby to change the dynamic of a marriage. Could a dog do the same thing? And then there was Ira's issue, which I couldn't shake. Did I have enough affection for both him and a dog? In the spring, we started visiting animal shelters. But there was only one breed I imagined owning, a beagle. And there weren't any available, so I started looking online, also in vain. The day in May after I reluctantly put down the deposit for the mini dachshund, I was tortured with recrimination. Why couldn't I make myself want her? Is the problem, Ira asked, you don't think you can care for a dog? She's just not the dog I imagined losing my freedom for, I wailed like a freaked out groom before his wedding night. She's too small. She's just too gay. I was sitting at my computer in a cold sweat, searching for beagles with the guilt of a porn addict. Ira was disgusted. You just want something you think is cute, he said. But that dachshund needs a home. If you think a dog is just an accessory, then maybe you don't deserve to have one. I wanted to bark at him and bite his head off. Instead, I got into the car and seethed as I stepped on the gas and drove us back to the animal shelter. The administrator looked at me suspiciously. Did I want this little dog or not? Can we take her for another walk before I decide? I asked. A no-nonsense attendant in rain boots took us past rows of barking dogs, many big and scary, at least to me. The smell of the kennel was rank, the atmosphere fraught with desperation. When we reached the little dachshund's pen, she was on her hind legs against a cyclone fence, barking in an unbearably shrill tone, though she was wagging her tail. The attendant handed me her leash. Black and brown, and not much bigger than a ferret, she strained at it outside, paying us no heed as she yanked with surprising force and barked at each dog we passed in a way that put me on edge. "How can you stand that shrill barking?" one woman asked. I didn't know, but the dog must have sensed my equivocation because suddenly, at a moment when I wasn't holding her leash properly, what did I know about holding a leash? She ran from us down a winding road that led to the Long Island Expressway. It was horrifying. How did those stubby legs carry her so fast? Ira chased her, running in the middle of the road faster than I've ever seen him run. "Help!" he yelled. "I need help! Get the car!" I feared they'd both be hit by oncoming traffic and imagined my happily married life about to end all because of a little dog. Between the time I got into my car to chase her and the moment we caught her, I had a painful stab of the most profound sorrow, imagining a return to the hermetic life without Ira that I had led for most of my adult years. With the help of a passing driver, we caught the dog, put her in my car, and drove her back to the parking lot of the shelter, where we all sat in the front seat, catching our collective breath and getting over our shock. Ira was panting, as was the little dog in my lap, her heart pounding against my thigh. And soon enough, she calmed down and rested her long snout against my forearm. After such a dreadful experience, you'd think I'd be ready to give her back. Instead, I felt something in me shifting as she curled up and snuggled deeper into my arm. "All she wants is to be held," I said in a tone I'd have mocked an hour before. And that was that. A dog I originally disliked for cosmetic reasons instantly transformed me into the kind of myopic, cooing dog owner I had previously scorned. And without missing a beat, Ira found himself devoted and in love with her too. With us for 4 months now, she's been following me around the house with needy eyes that I never would have expected to find so engaging. And if, as I've heard before, the work of dogs is to love and be loved, then she is doing her job, maybe a little too well. Twice over the summer when returning from out of town, I caught myself looking forward to her greeting more than Ira's, and then feeling conflicted about it. And often when Ira and I hug or tussle, I find myself waiting for her to jump in to join us. Then there is the issue of bedtime. With the sober concern of parents dealing with the sleep issues of children, we debate whether to allow her in our bed. She doesn't take up much room, but she does manage to get between us, making it difficult for us to fall into our typical embrace before sleep. For now, I keep her off until dawn, when I let her out of her crate. She leaps onto the blankets, long black ears with fringed bottoms flapping behind her, right into Ira's arms to plant kisses on his face. As he cuddles with her, it feels like he's doing the same with me. That's how profoundly I feel we're all intertwined. It's ridiculous, I know. But then I sometimes think that dogs are around to make us sillier than we are. Well, they don't judge. George Eliot must have known that when she wrote that we love dogs because we long for an affection altogether ignorant of our faults. Certainly, they don't challenge you in the ways a spouse or parent or child can. But in their own way, they do get you to think beyond your own needs a little. If you don't believe that, try walking an unhappy dog at midnight in the pouring rain. Perhaps if I had had one while I was single, it would have helped prepare me for the demands of a relationship. One thing I know for certain, Ira had it wrong. Affection, I can now see, is not something one has in limited supply, like money or drinking water. It's more like a muscle that grows the more you use it. Or maybe it's an explosion, like nuclear fission. The other night we were on the couch with our wiggling dog in something between a tangle of caresses and a group hug. Ira couldn't have looked happier. "She's actually made you more affectionate towards me, not less," he said. "A little dog I didn't think I wanted has turned out to be exactly what we needed. We only had to tweak her name a tiny bit to make it work for our own self-consciously ironic purposes. Instead of Zoe, she is now Zoloft. And she is as good as her name."
That's Zachary Quinto reading Bob Morris's essay, An Affection Multiplier with 4 Feet and a Wet Nose. We'll catch up with Bob and Zoloft after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Bob Morris's essay was published 10 years ago, and Zoloft the dog is about 12 now. Bob brought Zoloft with him to the studio when he came to talk to us. And he says that over the past decade, she has lowered his IQ, but improved his marriage.
What shocked me after I wrote the essay was that I'd become some kind of an insane Mr. Rogers when I would walk this dog around the neighborhood. You know, Mr. Busy, don't bother me. I'm thinking of the next essay to write. All of a sudden, I find myself literally picking this dog up in my arms and holding her like a baby so that people can pet her face and belly. I really do believe she's lowered my intelligence by at least 20 points. And it wasn't all that high in the first place that I could lose that, especially as a writer.
Bob likes the fact that Zoloft has absolutely no clue, nor does she care, about any of his successes or failures.
I mean, this dog has no idea how many walls I've hit in my career since I wrote that essay. You know, I mean, let's see, I can remember HBO passing on a show when I first got the dog. And I do remember having to lie down, and she was right there on my chest, and our breath pretty much synchronizes, even though she's much littler than me. It's not only that I do have a wonderful marriage and husband and good friends and family, but they're not always there, and you don't always want to tell them about a disappointment that knocks your self-esteem very hard. I mean, you know, a knock to self-esteem is a huge cause of depression. And yet this dog is ignorant of all of that. If I'm depressed and I come home and I open the door, she is going to be there being so excited to see me, far more excited than any publisher or producer and occasionally, or even my husband. But that dog is spinning. She literally spins in joy when I walk in the door, right? And so if it's a really bad day, do you know what I do? I go back out, close the door, and walk in again.
And Zoloft has also helped Bob and his husband Ira connect.
When we first got together, the idea of falling asleep entwined in an embrace was out of the question, you know, because as a certified light sleeper, there was no way that I was going to be able to fall asleep with him in my arms. And now, of course, I find that even the snoring helps me. And then, you know, you add in a dog who just has to be nestled up against you. And to me, even if I accomplish nothing else in my life, you know, to have accomplished this beautiful domestic feeling is, you know, is enough for me.
And Zoloft got her own last word in, too.
Zoloft, say goodbye. Zoloft, speak. Ruff! There you go. She said goodbye.
That's Bob Morris and Zoloft. Bob is a contributor to the New York Times and author of Bobby Wonderful and Assisted Loving. More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I actually get a lot of essays about the love of dogs, but love of a dog isn't really what the column's about. It's really about love between people. But we publish essays that include dogs if that dog sort of is able to open a window into the relationship. And that's completely the case in Bob's essay. Every decision about the dog sort of shines a light into their relationship, and that's ultimately what wins the day with this essay. It's just, it's funny and dramatic, and the way that pets can reveal relationships is what I really liked about Bob's essay.
And here's Zachary Quinto.
I'm a huge dog lover. I've had dogs for the last 15 years of my life, and I totally relate to so many aspects of how they fit into a life and a relationship. And I was never reluctant to get a dog. I was always like a real enthusiast, and I actually did have a dog for years while I was single, and I do think that it taught me a lot about how to navigate the demands of a relationship and get outside of myself. And I just feel like dogs are so healing, and they're such teachers and guides. And I think that they reflect back at us so much vulnerability and an innate kind of wisdom. And I just thought this story really captured that somehow, that I felt really resonated for me. So I was happy to be able to read it.
Thanks again to Zachary Quinto for reading this week's piece. You can see him now in Nosferatu on AMC. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Our intern is Shemi Oloko. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I dedicate this week's episode to our late great puppy, Luigi. We miss you every day, old boy. We'll see you next week.